still very high, and it's quite clear that he's not coming in for his bombing run. Earlier this evening, we could hear occasionally, again, those were explosions overhead. Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away. Just overhead now, the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. Still, the nearby guns are not working, and the searchlights now are feeling almost directly overhead. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
It's likely that the most famous radio broadcast of an American from London is still Edward R. Murrow reporting for CBS during the Blitz. But English radio had a long-standing influence upon American radio and vice versa. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Whether it was Edward R. Murrow's war reporting, the imaginative broadcasts of Norman Corwin, or the long-lived Letters from America by Alastair Cook, how did the two countries affect each other when it came to radio and television? How did radio and TV change with the advent of satellite delivery programs? And how does broadcasting in the two countries differ today? Our guest is Michelle Hilmes, professor of media and cultural studies and director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here again.
Well, there's a sign here at the building for Wisconsin Public Radio saying oldest station in the nation, but it doesn't say oldest station in the world. What is the relationship between English radio broadcasting and American broadcasting in terms of its origins?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question that has a lot to do with the way that the relationship shaped up over the years, because one thing I think we don't fully appreciate in this country, we know that we had a really strong history of amateur broadcasting before, you know, more of formal commercial radio broadcasting began. And of course, WHA was a part of that. You had people like Professor Earl Terry and his students on the air here experimenting, but hundreds of radio amateurs by 1922, which is when WHA actually got its formal license, were out there. And I think what people don't realize is how unique the United States was in that regard, because in most nations, including England, amateurs were not allowed on the air after World War I. It was considered a pretty politically sensitive period of, you know, rebuilding and nation building and all the kind of Red Scare in Russia. And so British amateurs didn't get a chance to go on the air while Americans were all over the place. And that's really how the BBC, in many ways, was able to become a monopoly broadcaster in Britain. Here, it would have been hard to do with all those amateurs out there fighting with anybody who tried to take
and
control.
And I gather very few rules at that point for what you could put on the air.
Very few. I mean, it was really a wide open frontier. And in fact, some of the amateurs organized into groups like the American Radio Relay League were very politically active in keeping it that way. They did not want to be controlled. They knew they had something really precious in this kind of freedom of communication, and they worked hard to keep it that way. That's why when RCA formed in 1919, of course, it was kind of early then. People weren't doing a whole lot of voice broadcasting even. But the American amateurs made sure that RCA, although it might control the radio manufacturing patents, didn't control broadcasting. It certainly wasn't the only company that could own stations or be on the air, but that's exactly what happened in Britain when the post office, the general post office, part of the government, got the major radio manufacturers in England together and said, okay, divide up broadcasting amongst yourselves, and you're the only ones who get to broadcast, too. And that's really the beginning of the BBC.
So BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, how far back does it go then, and how is it linked to the government?
It was actually formed in 1922 as the British Broadcasting Company, and it was not a government agency then. It was simply a consortium of manufacturers, but under the supervision of the post office. And it was important for the post office to supervise the BBC because the newspaper industry was very, very concerned when they looked over at the United States and they saw all the advertising that was on the air, even by then.
Afraid of losing revenue.
Afraid of losing revenue. And it just so happens that the post office in Britain got a considerable amount of revenue from its wire service monopoly. And so it was very much in line with the newspapers to not wanting – they didn't want to jeopardize that income.
Well, radio was in a position, because it could move more quickly than newspapers, to scoop stories. News wasn't anything like the industry then than it is now, but radio was faster if some breaking news – came up.
It certainly could be, and the newspapers knew that, although in the U.S. everybody said, no, it won't hurt your advertising revenue. People will want more news. And indeed, that seems to have happened. But at the time, they didn't know that, and so the BBC was originally formed to really provide a monopoly of broadcasting. There were only 8 stations in England. They covered That was sufficient to cover most of the country, all under a unified control of the British Broadcasting Company, which became the British Broadcasting Corporation in 1926 through a charter, a government charter, which meant that the government owned the stations, but the BBC was an arm's-length organization that operated them outside of direct control, but still with supervision from Her Majesty's or His Majesty's government, it would have been back then.
We think of the BBC now as sort of higher quality, more educational, more literary, more cultural than American radio or TV. Is that because of its origins as a sort of non-amateur group?
Well, interestingly, one thing that being a publicly chartered organization meant was it was non-commercial. And you'll hear that defended, of course. The BBC to this day does not accept advertising. It's funded by a license fee that every household has to pay, which amounts these days, I think, to around $200 a year. It's regressive. Everybody has to pay it, whether you're a multimillionaire or a mother on welfare. But that non-commercialness seemed to always put it in a place where it could afford to do what we might call more highbrow educational programs. And certainly its first director, John Reith, Sir John Reith as he was later, is often credited with starting and encouraging that public service tradition. Now, I would argue that probably the best friend that the BBC ever had was actually American broadcasting. Because any time anybody in England wanted to say, what would happen if we had commercial broadcasting? Yes, they would say, look at that chaos in America. And chaos is the word that you always hear. It's chaos. All the amateurs are on the air. There's commercial station. They're babbling on about, you know, liver pills and Beethoven in the same sentence. It's a mess over there. And if we want to keep things higher quality, we'd better hang on to our tighter system of control and our non-commercial base.
Well, what about freedom of expression? In other words, if you've got even at arm's length from the government, nevertheless, it is a government-controlled broadcasting system, how free were those on the air to criticize the government?
Well, many people feel they were not very free at all, although there were folks within the BBC who fought for a level of freedom. A lot of people look back to 1926, which was the year of the general strike in Britain, when industries across the nation went on strike jointly and, you know, tried to shut things down and protest against labor conditions. And the BBC sided with the government and helped to break the strike and to get around the protests. And many people felt right then that the BBC had declared itself to be a government agency rather than actually an agency of the people. But beyond that, there certainly were a lot of controls on what could be said and done. I mean, you can imagine if you just had one broadcaster, one, and that was your only choice. You might get the national service or there might be a regional station, both operated by the BBC. They had to be pretty selective in what they put on, and it was a highly selective business. And I think one thing I think is interesting, getting back to Edward R. Murrow perhaps, is that providing a national news service was really not something the BBC thought it was its duty to do until right around World War II. Ironically, in the United States, where there were so many stations and, you know, three networks by then, neither did the national networks here think that news was something that they should provide as a national service.
Well, I gather part of the problem, the concern in this country with news was that in order to be legitimate, it was supposed to be live. And how could you get live news? Because it would happen before you could get there in many cases.
Which was a problem, too, because good recording equipment, of course, didn't exist that was really very portable. Most of us have heard the recording of the Hindenburg disaster.
1937.
Which is one of the first recorded, you know, live events that
was
broadcast.
And I gather that was accidental. He was actually Herb Morrison was actually out trying to just kind of experiment, well, what could we do with recorded news, with an actuality, as they call them? And lo and behold, he had one of the big stories of the century right there with his equipment.
Running, yeah. He did not anticipate that. And really, it wasn't picked up on in the United States. There wasn't a lot of use of recorded news. The BBC actually began recording before the U.S. did because they didn't have the same prejudice, if you will, towards liveness as a sign of quality, oddly enough. They recorded programs from the beginning and thought that was perfectly okay. So it's odd, our ideas of quality. But certainly most of the news in the U.S. before World War II were either just brief newscasts where the reporters were basically reading from a wire service report, or it was done by local stations, you know, stations, especially the ones owned by newspapers in cities and towns around the country who did their own news gathering. But CBS and NBC had very small, I mean, almost non-existent news departments until 1938 or 39.
Well, in that chaos that was American broadcasting, was there some good material coming out? In other words, yes, it's easy to dismiss it, that it's got commercials, that it's amateurs and so on. But in that mess of programming that was there when the British looked over across the Atlantic, did they see something to imitate as well?
It's interesting to me that if you look at the policy documents, it's all in Britain, oh, let's avoid being like the Americans as much as we can. And then over here, it's who wants to have a government-controlled radio system? All the policy discourses, just opposites, we're opposites. But in fact, the people who worked in the industry looked back and forth across the Atlantic all the time and were constantly borrowing ideas from each other. In the wake of the Communications Act of 1934, when American broadcasters were told they'd better provide more public service programming, where did they look for a model? Directly to the BBC. So pretty soon, NBC had the NBC Symphony Orchestra. Of course, the BBC had the BBC Symphony Orchestra for a good long time. You had things like the Columbia Workshop, the CBS Workshop of the Air, Mercury Theater, patterned after the drama programs that emphasized the single play on the BBC.
Lux Radio Theater, to some extent.
Lux Radio Theater is kind of an interesting case because it was movie adaptations.
Yes.
And
but
that was considered high class. But, I'm not sure the BBC would have touched
right,
that at the
yes.
time. But, yeah, certainly for, it was considered a very high quality program. On the other hand, as the BBC started to feel that it had to popularize more in the late 1930s, and I have to say that part of that was when John Reith left the BBC and sort of took that iron grip away, they looked directly over to what the American networks were doing, and you start to see the advent of popular programs on the BBC, like quiz shows. I don't know if you remember the show Information,
Please.
Oh, yes,
Please. Very popular in this country with celebrity
Indeed.
Guests.
Yes, and they did a version of that called The Brain's Trust in Britain that became one of its most popular shows.
And what was the motivation over there? If you're looking to increase your numbers, is it just because you want to, or is there any other incentive if you already have a lock on the system?
Well, that, I think you put your finger on one of the issues that kept the BBC from popularizing for so long. They didn't need the numbers, and in fact, they didn't even know the numbers. They did not institute listener research at all until 1936. They first hired one person and then finally started to do it seriously in 1938. It didn't matter. As many of them said, it's not so much that we should follow. We should lead popular taste. Hmm. And that's how the BBC thought of its job. What happened to change it was really the rumblings of war. The British government realized that to build wartime morale and to recruit the nation into this struggle, they were going to have to reach out and going to have to provide programs that spoke to everyone, not just an educated elite. And they began to do that in about 1938-39. And that's where the American influence became really strong.
And how was that influence reaching Britain? In other words, if there are American shows over here, who was it that was listening and adapting and copying? And
who was listening within
in England
to these American shows? Well, that's interesting because it kind of ties into another little chapter of the story, which is that in 1932, the BBC was one of the first broadcasting organizations to start deliberately broadcasting outside the country, what we now call external broadcasting, like the Voice of America or that sort of thing. They were one of the first. They started the British Empire Service to broadcast to their empire possessions around
the
world.
Shortwave.
Yeah.
No.
Shortwave.
Rather than AM.
And as things built up in Europe and the Nazis started to do external broadcasting of what was considered pretty hard-hitting propaganda, so did Italy, so did most nations start to broadcast externally. The BBC realized that it needed to build up its empire or external broadcasting, and it started what was then called the Overseas Service. And that's where a lot of the pressure to popularize came from as well. But it meant that a lot of people were now listening in via shortwave what they could pick up from the United States, because the U.S. networks were also beginning to send out the South America and various other places shortwave programs. They would listen in at night and then bring some of those ideas back into the boardroom the next day to say, hey, here's a good idea I've got for a program I heard last night.
What did the English do on the eve of World War II to enlist American sympathies, America being a neutral country until Pearl Harbor? How did they use radio to get the American sympathy?
Well, for one thing, a special branch of the empire, now called the North American Service, was started in 1939-40. And that branch began broadcasting a special program to North America to recruit Americans to feel sympathy for the British side of the war that was then, you know, going forward, and also to help keep up morale in Canada. And in fact, it became, I think, much more influential really in Canada than here, because the CBC would rebroadcast quite a few of the North American service. So you could pick it up on shortwave, but the British also started to try to get American regular wave, you know, normal radio stations to air their programs. One problem was they were often recorded, and Americans considered that low quality and didn't necessarily like to pick up the British programs, but they
did. Again, recording had the stigma of being somehow dishonest.
Yes, that, you know, it wasn't really, you know.
It wasn't really happening while you were listening to it.
Mm-hmm. And were there other models? I know you mentioned Germany and Italy were doing propaganda in terms of their use of radio, but were there any other models besides England and America that were kind of playing into the story? In other words, France or somewhere else where they were using radio in creative ways?
Well, it's interesting that usually you hear of the, you know, the three models of broadcasting that were developed in the 20s and 30s. The privately owned commercial model, which was the United States, the public service model, which was Great Britain, and then the directly government controlled model, which was Germany under the Nazis, the Russian government, increasingly the Italian system. But actually there were lots of variations. France had a few government owned stations, but also private commercial ones, which incidentally had started to broadcast over the channel into Britain by 1936 or 38, airing American-inspired commercial programs that were starting to be popular. And then my favorite is the Netherlands, that devised a system they call the Pillared System, which gave one station to the Catholic Church, one station to the Protestant churches, one to the labor unions, and then one to a kind of a radio society. And that's how broadcasting was organized in the Netherlands for a long time.
We'll see how it developed in this country and also in England as we got into World War II when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Was a town, and is a town, and you'll find it on a map of the east coast of England, in the ancient division of the country called East Anglia, facing the North Sea, facing Germany. I set out by train for Cromer one sunny September morning, leaving from a station in the east end of London. Incidentally, you spell it with a C, not a K. C-R-O-M-E-R. Cromer. The things you notice on a train ride in a front line you wear. Small talk overheard. The beard on the man sitting opposite. The pattern of the holes punched in your ticket by the conductor.
Change at Cambridge for Cromer.
Yes, I know. Thank you. Little differences in railway manners, such as etchings on the walls of the compartments, and the fact that when the steward comes through to announce lunch, he doesn't yell, "First call for lunch," but says,
"Those requiring lunch will please go forward to the dining, coach."
A lot of unimportant things stick in your mind. In the smoker, for example, I overheard two officers, a Canadian and an Englishman, talking very earnestly. Do you suppose they were discussing the war? Or the Commonwealth of Nations? Or sports? Women, horses, books? Not at all. They were saying,
"But what does Coca-Cola taste like, Coca?"
Well,
From Columbia Presents Corwin, a 1942 broadcast called simply Cromer. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Michelle Hilmes, and we're talking about the way American versus English broadcasting, radio and TV, developed over the course of a few decades. That Norman Corwin wrote, and you tell me that another great American broadcaster, Edward R. Murrow, actually was the instigator behind it.
And he was actually the producer of the program. Yeah, Edward R. Murrow is a really interesting figure in the relationship between British and American broadcasting. And even though he's known more today for his role in the McCarthy debacle, as the recent movie brought home to everybody, I think truly his contribution to American broadcasting is more in the shaping and structuring of American news and British news, setting the standard, developing a form of first-person intimate narration, putting together by the seat of his pants the system of foreign correspondence as war broke out in Europe. That was something a network had never done before, not the BBC, not CBS, not NBC, and really putting the news out, accessible, directed at a wide audience in a way that had never been done before. And not only was that influential on American network news, but it also had quite an influence within the BBC, where he worked very closely.
The thing about Cromer was the assignment, whether it came from Murrow or through Corwin in some other way, was to go to this place that was actually being hit by the Germans and report on it. And Corwin uses this pastoral technique. I mean, he describes in very calm detail all these buildings that are bombed out, and talks about how, you know, the British are taking this as the British do, with the stiff upper lip. And it must have really helped British-American solidarity in the war.
You know, I think it's true that people like Norman Corwin and Edward R. Murrow were probably ambassadors to the general public in a way that, you know, political ambassadors could never hope to be. And it's interesting, too, that Murrow and Corwin in these broadcasts had a style of bringing in the voice of the common man, you know, talking to people on the street. Now, this is something the BBC hadn't done much of before the war. And it was really through the influence of people like Murrow, not that there weren't people within the BBC who had been wanting to do this for a long time. For instance, Richard Dimbleby, who would become a famous broadcaster after the war, his son is still on the air today, would develop a style very much like Murrow's, and I think very much influenced by him after the war. But Murrow was a very influential figure. He was very well liked within the BBC. People respected him. The strange thing is that when he went to London in 1937, he had absolutely no journalistic experience or training whatsoever.
What had he been doing?
He had been working for an international educational organization where his task was to line up speakers from overseas to speak at various colleges and universities. And so he'd gotten to know people in Europe. And CBS, in the wake, again, of the Communications Act of 1934, developed a new position in the network. It was called Director of Talks. Now, they'd never had a Director of Talks before, and that's taken directly from the BBC, where they'd had a Director of Talks since the beginning. But his job was to go to London and arrange broadcasting dates for famous figures, politicians, celebrities, anyone who would be interesting to the American audience, and to bring them into the BBC at night, because, of course, that was, you know, daytime during the in the U.S., and set up these broadcasts. And that's what he was doing. That's all he was doing. He was not a newsman. He was not collecting news. He was never on the air himself, simply arranging broadcasts for others, until the Anschluss in 1939. And that is when he and William Shirer found themselves CBS's, you know, men in Europe to cover this crisis.
When Germany took, in effect, took over
Austria. Invaded
Austria.
And that's when he began to set up the system of stringers, you know, reporters stationed in
calling
the various
from
capitals.
The field.
Now they're often referred to as Murrow's boys. You might have heard that. Although there were some girls in there, too, like Mary Marvin Breckinridge. And indeed, doing regular newscasts and reporting on the scene was something that the American radio networks had not done before.
And did he have to think about numbers and listeners and sort of the commercial side of it, or was that something that he considered himself above?
I think Murrow came away from his experience and developed while he was in Britain an admiration for what the American system of broadcasting could do, its freedom. I'm digressing just a moment, but he actually was specially handled by the British government. They knew that if Murrow were censored or restrained in what he could say, the way that the BBC reporters were censored and constrained, that he would report that back in the United States, and that would be the biggest argument against getting in the war on the side of Britain that you could think of. So he was actually able to report breaking events that happened in England before it could be reported over British radio. And sometimes British reporters from the BBC would call up and say, what did you say last night? You know, I missed that. You know, what's going on?
There's some irony there, isn't there?
Yes. He was actually able to do that in the United States, and the BBC was the organization that really encouraged him along those lines.
On this side of the Atlantic, was there a counterpart? What do you think would be the closest counterpart to Murrow reporting the American scene to the English?
Well, there are two people, actually, and one of them is better known than the other. You may have heard the name of Raymond Graham Swing, who was doing a broadcast from New York on the BBC about America for a number of years and continued throughout the war. But the person who became very well known had to struggle to get the BBC to accept him, but then became an institution, is, of course, Alastair Cook, whose letter from America actually started during the war. But he'd had some other broadcasts that he'd put on about the United States and its culture back to the BBC. And he, of course, became an American citizen later, but I think he remains sort of an interpreter of America to Britain.
No doubt about that.
Well, definitely a cultural figure if you think of Alistair Cookie on Sesame Street. probably one of the more recognizable figures from all of public television.
Exactly. And don't forget there was that famous show, though not so long lived, called Omnibus.
Very Tony American. Yes. Broadcasting.
Kind of public television before there was public television that
early
ran on the commercial networks. Yes. And he was the host of that and was selected, you know, precisely to have that kind of role. So then, of course, going to PBS with Masterpiece Theater was not that big a step.
So what was he reporting then, the early Alistair Cook? What was he saying about America?
It's interesting in that, you know, he was not a news reporter. He was not covering breaking news. He did not see it as his task to report on politics and the hard news. He wanted to get the culture of America across to Britain. And it's kind of funny that when he first proposed that idea before the war broke out in about 1938, there's a memo in the BBC files that says, "While I think it is important for the Americans to know about the British, I do not feel yet to know more about Americans in Britain at this point." But Alistair Cook kept pushing. He said, "Yes, you do. The British public should get to know American culture and understand it for what it is." And I think he was one of the biggest mediators between the two.
As we get to the end of the war, 1945, do things change at all? Or is this slack off, or does it increase this traffic between America and Britain?
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, you'd have to say that World War II was the first time that the two nations really came together, cooperated with each other, borrowed a lot of ideas. There were actually a lot of transatlantic broadcasts going on that were participatory. There was a show called Transatlantic Quiz that had players on both sides of the Atlantic who would, you know, answer questions, and other shows like that. And then, of course, you have to remember that the American Armed Forces Radio Service had the American Forces Network set up in England. When you think about it, the first time that Britain had ever allowed another country to broadcast on its airwaves to its home country. So a lot of Britons were listening to American radio that was being broadcast for the troops, but that anybody could listen into there. So that's quite a coming together. Now, after the war, there was a bit of a desire to separate, to say, okay, enough of that. Let's go back and think about, you know, who we are as Britons and what should British radio be like, and same thing with the United States. So I think that there was a kind of a moving away. But then, of course, as television came in, and particularly as commercial television was introduced into Britain in 1955, you see the beginning of a second wave of cross-influence during that time.
What prompted that introduction of commercial television?
Well, I think many people feel that, in fact, there are many conspiracy theories out there. There were some books written at the time that basically said that American advertisers and television companies, you know, had conspired with certain venal people in the Parliament and in the British industry to foist this unwanted thing upon the British public. But in fact, the British public had been listening to commercial stations from across the Channel, Radio Luxembourg, Radio Normandy before the war, and were very fond of them. In fact, it looked like about a third of the British public was tuning in to Radio Luxembourg for its soaps, its series, its variety shows after the war. So there was that. People realized that there was a demand for popular programs. Also, British advertisers found it very unfair that they were denied this medium of broadcasting radio and television now when other countries had commercial – well, actually, America had commercial TV. Not any other country in Europe at that point had commercial TV. And so when the Tories came into power in the early 1950s, there was a lot of support for introducing commercial TV, almost ruined – by the terrible events that happened during the coronation of Elizabeth II in 1953.
And if I've got to ask.
Well, if I tell you it involved J. Fred Muggs, perhaps you'll remember that name. He was the chimpanzee who co-hosted the Today Show with Dave Garraway on NBC back then.
I don't know anything about this chimpanzee. Tell me about
that. He was a very charming chimpanzee. He was often dressed in, you know, children's clothing, and he would cavort around the stage, and Dave Garraway would use him just as sort of a prop. And a.
Well, I
and
hope he got a salary.
I'd like to look into that.
He was the top banana.
But the BBC had been very, very specific that if the coverage of the coronation, which they were taking – They were still a monopoly broadcaster in 53. This is the first time a royal event had been televised. And they wanted to share it with the American networks, but it had to be done very respectfully. There could not be any advertising in the coronation broadcast. You know, no cutting away from the placing of the crown to a laxative ad or something. Yeah. It had to be used in certain specific ways. And the networks agreed to do that. But then word got out that the Queen had been seen in juxtaposition to a monkey on the Today Show. And that almost derailed commercial broadcasting in Great Britain in 1953. People said, you know, this is what will happen. See? This is what commercial broadcasting does. But it did come in 55 nonetheless.
And was the rise of McCarthyism, did that play a role in terms of, I don't know, how patriotic you had to be or monitoring of what went on the air?
I don't think the political concerns were as pressing as the cultural concerns at that point, that, you know, there was this American commercial culture because, of course, this is the 50s, right? And rock and roll is beginning to spread across the world. The American film industry has all but wiped out the British film industry and a lot of European film industries as well. Teenagers, Bobby Sox, Blue Jeans, Coca-Cola.
All of which were, let's say, foreign to the British at this point, not nearly cultural wash back and forth that we have now.
And it was just felt that commercial television, if American influence were allowed in, would just accelerate this process. And so what you get, though, is once ITV, that was the commercial network, independent television, which was very heavily regulated. I mean, American commercial broadcasters would not recognize this as commercial TV almost, although it had ads. They had to think about how they were going to get an audience. And one thing they started to do was to import American programs, some of which became the top-rated programs in England. I think Bonanza was the top British program for 3 years. I Love Lucy.
I noticed Ben Cartwright starting to talk with a slight British accent after about 1958.
Yes, that was deliberate, you know.
He was a Canadian, after all. That must have helped.
Well, you know, Canadians actually form a kind of an interesting piece of the story because often the American influence was softened and filtered through Canada. So Canadians would come to the BBC and bring popularizing reforms that, you know, Americans themselves could not do. But the exchange of programs became very widespread, and ITV in particular, by 1958, had captured 60% of the television audience, had gone right past the BBC. And at that point, BBC realizes they needed to do something about that, to make their own popular programs and also to somewhat regulate the ITV programs so that, you know, they didn't – and you can understand why. To turn a television service over to that programs of another country didn't seem like a good idea. But what could they do? They could make their own programs that used American models.
But in a British, with a British voice.
A British voice, a British take, sort of a British translation. And, you know, that's how culture works. That's what artists do. They take an idea perhaps from somewhere else, make it their own. Now, I don't think many in Britain were regarding this as an art back then, but nonetheless.
I'm sure they weren't expecting Monty Python at that point.
You see what happened?
Yeah, they were right, weren't they?
More on British and American radio and TV when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Conserve School, an interdisciplinary college preparatory boarding high school in northern Wisconsin. Conserve School's curriculum emphasizes the environment, ethics, and innovation. Information on the web at conserveschool.org.
The BBC presents Life with the Lions. Our old friend Ben has always believed in the theory that travel is the best form of education. So last month he booked tickets for a long Mediterranean cruise, and Barbara, Richard, and Ben went along to improve their minds. BB, well, she went along just for the trip. Anyway, the cruise is almost over now, so let's go aboard and travel the rest of the way with the Lion.
Well, BB, just two more days.
I know. I wish we could go on holidays all the time.
You do, eh?
Yes, because I'm never as happy as I am when we're going home.
Well, it's a pretty expensive way of getting happy.
I don't care. I want to be back in our own little home and see our...
That's an excerpt from Life with the Lions, a family sitcom popular on British radio. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Michelle Helms. We're talking about the English-American radio and TV connection. So tell us what we just heard there. That's not a show that I think made it big over here.
I don't know that it ever aired in the United States, but if, you know, as soon as most of us heard that, we probably thought immediately of I Love Lucy, of Ozzie and Harriet, of just a hundred American radio and TV sitcoms of the 50s and 60s. And this was actually an American couple, B.B. Daniels and Ben Lyon. They lived in England and became very popular on British radio during World War II. Started this program on radio in 1951. It then went to television and became a huge hit, one of the most popular family programs that was on the air during that time. And I think it kind of marks a point where British radio and television were beginning to take American models very directly. You know, you had your family, your sitcom family, just very much along the same lines as what was happening and had been going on in the U.S. for about a decade.
And were there any characteristics that made it different other than, I mean, let's say you're listening to an excerpt from a British family sitcom, other than the accents that you might pick up on, is there anything else that you notice as a difference?
You know, I've listened to several of these episodes. I haven't, of course, listened to the whole oeuvre, which would take months out of anyone's life. But aside from the accents of the supporting characters, who, of course, are British, and then references to things that are British, like there's an episode called Fairy Cakes. Now, I don't think that's something we would recognize, but it's a type of pastry in England. And the whole joke is that B.B. Lyons cannot make any pastry that doesn't weigh less than 10 pounds, you know. That's what you'd notice. I think otherwise it would be so familiar.
Situations are the same.
Very much the same. And I don't know why it couldn't have aired here. Maybe we just had so many of our own. It wasn't, you know, really marketed to us.
No. We did have some things that came from Britain, though, other than Alistair Cook. They were quite popular in this country. And blended in quite well with the American scene.
And in fact, formed an important part of many of our childhoods, I think. I know that I used to rush home from school so that I could do my homework before the rerun at that point of The Adventures of Robin Hood came on, one of my favorite shows. And I have to say that as a scholar, I've had few more delightful discoveries. And I only discovered this a couple of years ago, that those episodes of Robin Hood that I was watching were in fact produced in England with a British cast, produced by a woman named Hannah Dorner Weinstein from Los Angeles, who one person actually claimed was funded by the American Communist Party, but I found no evidence of that, Robin Hood,
taken from the rich and giving to the poor.
But what she did was set up a production company and hired blacklisted American film and television writers, including Ring Lardner Jr., Albert Maltz, and some of the other Hollywood Ten, Waldo Salt, who all wrote episodes of Robin Hood. Yes, and exactly. Take from the rich, give to the poor. Perfect. And so here we were soaking that up, I guess, in our youth as it aired all over the United States and reran for years, a classic program.
And how did it get from there to here then?
By this time, they were shooting on film. Television programs were being, in America, by 1958, were being always shot on film. And that's kind of an interesting thing, too, because the BBC, for a long time, held off, did not shoot on film. Now they went to live because live was cheaper. Television was expensive, and it was much less expensive to do a live television program than to film it.
Which is a rarity today.
Very rare today. But, of course, the problem with a live show is that you can't syndicate it or sell it elsewhere, can you?
Yes, it's ephemeral.
It's ephemeral.
You play it once and it's gone. And all, not to mention, although I suppose they had their act together, but a lot of times quality control can be, as we know from the early days of American television, the bouncing baby problem where it literally drops out of the mother's arms and takes a tumble down the stairs.
Many blooper shows have come out of this. No, indeed, if you could shoot on film, you could sell overseas. And that's exactly where some American companies saw a niche, located to England so they could qualify under the British tax laws, but produce programs that were popular both in the U.S. and Britain. And this continued, into the 60s.
Did satellite just totally change everything in terms of making these programs almost immediately available both sides of the Atlantic?
Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that, yes, that we'd arrived at a detente of sorts in the 60s and 70s. There were many British programs that aired on American television. We can probably remember The Avengers and The Saint and The Prisoner and many others.
Roger Moore and Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg.
Those well-known shows. And then there were the adaptations of things like Till Doth Us Do Part, which resulted in All in the Family, or Steptoe and Son, which became Sanford and Son. So with quite a few British adaptations in the U.S. that were very, popular and, for which the British producers received a fee. But when satellites came along in the mid-1980s, now all of a sudden, people in Europe who still mostly had public service broadcasting systems and very few commercial outlets suddenly had direct access to American movies and television programs. And this created, it's part of a bigger phenomenon of commercialization and privatization. But the term that came to stand for it all was Dallasification. Because it was Dallas that proved so incredibly popular around the world, and public service broadcasters were aghast. Wall-to-wall Dallas is another phrase that regulators thought was going to happen in Europe after satellites.
Well, it gets back to that whole question of what's it for?
What is broadcasting for?
Yeah. Well, and the formation of PBS and that comes along before that, too.
And, that's another very interesting story because I don't know if you know this, but the producer of Dynasty, or Dynasty, as they pronounce it in Britain, claims that she was inspired by the PBS broadcast of I, Claudius.
Oh, sure.
And that's the genesis of Dynasty. Well, no, seriously,
so
though.
So Dallas, it would have been Rome.
Well, and Rome. There's a long history of BBC, PBS co-productions that start in the 70s and become really big by the late 70s. By the late 70s, 80% of BBC drama series are being underwritten by American investors in some way or another. And it's that mini-series format, which is the format that British drama was always presented in. They didn't like these long, never-ending series, right? Rather to have a short series of, say, 8 or 10 episodes.
Yeah, a mini-series.
Mm-hmm. A mini-series. And that's where we got the idea of the mini-series in this country, and particularly from seeing the shows on PBS, which were so much imported from Britain, or BBC US co-productions, British U.S. co-productions, I should say.
The soap operas still seem to have survived through that nonetheless.
Serials, in fact, if you look at the top-rated programs in England right now, they have their equivalent of Broadcasting Magazine where they do all the top-rated shows. They have to have a special box for top-rated serials, because if they didn't, it would just be Coronation Street, EastEnders, Coronation Street, EastEnders, and a few others. The top programs and everything else, except for a few soccer matches, far behind, because the British did finally adopt the serial format. And of course, as they would say, did it better.
Alistair Cook did make one distinction, though, during Masterpiece Theory. He sounded defensive one time. He said, what's the difference between what you're doing and a soap opera? And he says, well, what we're doing is not done by formula.
Well, I don't know. It seems like Masterpiece Theater had a kind of a formula, don't you think, of adaptations of literary properties.
It does get to be a pretty thin line, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I was thinking that, you know, the exchange that we've been talking about, whether with radio or TV between England and America, that although there's an exchange going on, couldn't you also argue that there's a reinforcement of stereotypes or differences, that Americans liked Alistair Cook because of his sort of formal British accent that always makes everything sound highbrow, even if it's not, and that the British probably loved the, you know, the American Dallas, you know, the Hollywood kind of big screen braggadocio or whatever, that there's a kind of celebration of the otherness.
That's exactly right. And I think that in a way you could say that American popular television has underwritten British television for decades now, supplying what they call the cheap and cheerful shows, you know, the comedy series, the kind of lightweight dramas that bring in the audiences and justify the BBC's license fee and help the broadcasters in their ratings competition in England, but that the BBC and ITV really don't want to make themselves. That's not what they specialize in. There was one guy who bought all of the films and foreign series that aired on the BBC and on the ITV channels throughout the 70s and 80s. And his name was Leslie Halliwell. He's written also some books on film that you might be familiar with. But he said quite definitely that, yes, we don't want quality shows from America. That's not what we buy them for.
we
do that ourselves. Instead, we want the popular ones. But you could also say then that it's British broadcasting that in many ways has underwritten, in a way, American public television, because so many of those productions, although literally Americans do invest in them, the BBC has always been very stern that Americans do not influence the productions. They take the money, but there's no American involvement in the actual planning of the programs. Now, this is a BBC policy, which was established after quite a lot of heated meetings back in the 1970s. Does that really work? Don't they sort of take the American market into account when they make these programs? Well, indeed. And I think now we see a new era of HBO, BBC co-productions like
yes.
Rome,
right?
Like The Tudors. I think it's on Showtime. That, again, it's really, you know, it's transatlantic. We're
it
in a new era.
It seems as if you really want historical accuracy, you about have to co-produce with the BBC.
Well, but, you know, who knew the Romans had British accents? That was a revelation
anybody
to me.
Anybody who had seen I, Claudius.
You're right. You know, I guess we know they have British accents.
What about the game show tradition that whether you go back to the quiz show Scandals or up way up through the, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and its British-American counterparts and so on, what about the whole game show tradition on television?
Well, game shows are, you know, have been popular on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world. And in fact, it's amazing that the British have had mostly the same game shows that we've had all around. But what I call the revenge of the public service broadcasters began to happen in the late 1990s when all of a sudden the importation started going the other way. And we got Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And
right.
Even American Idol, although that's not a game show, but that
was based on Pop Idol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the reality programs, too, the kind of Big Brother and Survivor and that sort of thing, although some of them came from Sweden or the Netherlands. Usually they played in Britain first before we got them, and then we picked them up from there. So I think we've seen a real, you know, reversal of the current of popular shows that are thought of as not particularly good quality.
That are not coming from America.
That are coming from Europe to America.
Uh-huh.
And that's a real shift. Plus, getting back to the dramas, I mean, I think when I go to England, it's generally recognized right now that some of the best drama is coming from the United States.
Television drama.
Television drama.
Like
the,
what?
Like The Sopranos, Sex and the City, 24.
24.
Popular, high quality drama series that get big audiences but are also West Wing, you know, also respected. And many people feel the BBC just isn't producing that kind of drama anymore, although I don't know if that's in fact the case.
And where do you see things heading? I mean, if you look at sort of the 1990s and what you're talking about, sort of the reverse, the revenge going the other way and so on. But if you look into the future, where do you see things heading in terms of English-American television and radio?
You know, I think it's going to be very hard to separate out national traditions as we go on, because I think one thing that's starting to happen now that we haven't felt the impact of yet is the DVD box set. We no longer have to watch television within our national traditions. Even satellite broadcasting, which, you know, brings in quite a bit. I mean, most people don't subscribe to that, but everybody buys box sets. You can go on Netflix now and get all the British shows you would like, shows from other countries around the world, and with the ability of DVDs to be dubbed or subtitled in many languages, we no longer have a reason to watch within our national culture. Will we? I think we will. I think we always will, because we like our familiar culture. But I think that hopefully this country, which has really screened out more from abroad than most other nations have, will have a renaissance of exposure to the drama and comedy, et cetera, of other nations.
Although we hear of adapted endings, like the Austin Pride and Prejudice, where they made an American ending with a kiss, you know, to satisfy the taste.
I have a feeling that secretly, women, especially all over Britain, are watching that American version.
Yeah, I suspect that's true. Yeah. I would guess that the influences will no longer be nearly as tight as they were, though. I mean, as you get all these other countries producing things for, like telenovelas, for example, that become popular forms, and that you can get these so cheaply, pirated or otherwise, China or wherever else, that all of these things will tend to merge. You'll get a very serious BBC drama with a Jackie Chan kind of character knocking people down to the floor.
That's an interesting vision. But I'm sure you're right. Well, look at Ugly Betty. I think that's probably an example of a transnational adaptation, which started out in, I think it was Venezuela. And then I went to a conference and someone showed six different versions of Ugly Betty from all over Europe and Asia. And they're all a little bit the same, but slightly different. And that's your transnational property, I guess.
And what about the news? What would Edward R. Murrow say today about the news on either side of the Atlantic?
Well, I think Edward R. Murrow was fairly fed up with American network news by the time that he stepped down from CBS.
After doing Person to Person, for one, having to talk to celebrities.
Which many people felt was kind of a travesty. Mm-hmm. But again, in another weird twist, I don't know if you remember a documentary called Harvest of Shame.
Yes, very
groundbreaking,
much.
Influential documentary made under Murrow at CBS, part of the commitment to public service. When Murrow became director of USIA and hence in charge of Voice of America and the television broadcasting service, he actually tried to get Britain to not show Harvest of America on British television because he felt it created such a bad impression of the United States. And many people felt that was a real turnaround from everything that he had stood for. But he was also, you know, acting as an ambassador then in a different kind of a role. And I think that, you know, he had for a long time valued the United States system for its freedom, but in a way kind of stepped towards a more British and controlled idea of what television could do before the end. So I don't know where this clash of values quite ends, but I think you can certainly say that the American type of television has become dominant worldwide, and that really British and American TV are part of the same system. It's a universe that has a high end and a low end. That's now mixed up. I think we're really the same culture in many ways.
Michelle Hilmes has been our guest this hour. She'll be with us next hour, too, as we talk about other aspects of broadcasting. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for that hour of University of the Air.